You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hey everyone, Chris Webster here from the Archaeology Podcast Network, dropping into your feed with a quick update. The Heritage Voices podcast is taking a break this month, but we'll be back soon with more great content. In the meantime, we're bringing you something special. Episode 33 of the Ethnocynology podcast with David Ian Howe. In this episode, Dr. Todd Surivel joins the show to discuss groundbreaking new research suggesting that Monte Verde may no longer be considered a pre-Clovis site. Big news for our understanding of the peopling of the Americas. We hope you enjoy it.
If you're a fan of archaeology, especially archaeology in the Americas, you're probably used to seeing headlines that read something like, "Archaeologist Baffled," or "New Site Completely Rewrites the History of the Americas." Or more accurately, "New Site or New Study Completely Pushes Back the Date for Human Arrival in the Americas." However, today I'm here to tell you the exact opposite, because a new study just came out that said that the history of the Americas just got a whole lot younger, and here's why.
A major field of science got it wrong for a quarter century.
My name's David Ian Howe, I'm an anthropologist and archaeologist, and today we're going to be talking about the Monte Verde site. At the time of its publication, Monte Verde was some of the best evidence for pre-Clovis in the Americas. And not only pre-Clovis, but also some of the best evidence for human occupation in the Americas prior to the end of the last Great Ice Age. And while there was a lot of debate and a lot of arguments, and is this true, is it not true, is it fake, at the time, a team of researchers went down to Monte Verde and verified its integrity and said that yes, this is in fact a valid pre-Clovis site. And it ended up rewriting textbooks. And the reason why this is such a special site is how is something dated to 14,500 years ago, way down south in South America, how does that predate Clovis when the earliest dates for Clovis in North America only date to about 13,000 years ago? It was controversial, and that's why it rewrote the textbooks. All that said, this video will be an interview with Dr. Todd Surivel, who recently led a research team down to Monte Verde and conducted new archaeological and archaeometric testing and confirmed that the site is actually not older than Clovis. It's actually younger than Clovis. And with his research team and the study that just published, this study will also be groundbreaking. It might have to rewrite textbooks and it will be all over the news. So I'd like this video to serve as the place where you can get the definitive interview with the lead author on the paper about what he did, how he came to these conclusions, and how Monte Verde is possibly far younger than previously believed. Before we get started, though, I'd just like to state two things. One, I was not part of the research team. I was not part of the study. I did not go down to Monte Verde. I'm just relaying the information as best I can to you and providing you with the interview. And then two, just to state a bias, I was Dr. Todd Surivel's student. He was my academic advisor, as I've mentioned in previous videos. However, I disagree with Todd on several things, and I guess for this channel, I don't really have a dog in the fight on South American pre-Clovis archaeology. I'm just relaying the information as best I can. So with all that said, let's get into why Monte Verde is dead, or at least no longer a viable pre-Clovis site. The Americas were the last major continent colonized by humans. The timing of this colonization is heavily debated. For decades, the Clovis first model was the dominant theory, Clovis dating to, on average, about 13,000 years before the present. Monte Verde II in southern Chile became famous because it appeared to show human presence as far back as 14,500 years before the present. That's 1,500 years before Clovis. The site forced archaeologists to rethink migration routes, suggesting a coastal migration route instead of only an inland corridor on foot. You may be familiar with these two theories, the first of them being the ice-free corridor theory, in which humans crossed the Bering Land Bridge from Siberia into Alaska and then further colonized the peopling of the Americas on foot, chasing large game such as mammoth and bison down into the interior of North America in between the ice-free corridor. And the coastal migration route, the other one I mentioned there, is also known as the kelp highway hypothesis, as proposed by John Erlandson. And this is the idea that there's kelp forests that stretch all the way from basically Japan across the Aleutian Islands down the Pacific Northwest of America down to South America. And it's the idea that people were following this kelp highway, not just eating kelp, but hunting seals, collecting shellfish, and possibly parking on land at night to make camp and build a fire and get stone tools if they need to on the inland, but continue down the kelp highway all the way down to South America. If this is correct, that would explain how people got to Monte Verde that fast, 14,000 years ago. With the migration theories aside, back to the summary of the paper in my words, the study re-examines Monte Verde with modern dating methods and determines it is actually far younger than Clovis by more than 1,000 years. So What Todd's going to talk about is how Monteverde is in fact younger than Clovis, not older than Clovis. It is not a pre-Clovis site. So with the introduction and my summary out of the way, let's now introduce Dr. Todd Saraville, the lead author on the paper, and discuss the history of Monteverde, his history with Monteverde, and the current state of the site based on his recent findings. Todd?
I'm Todd Saraville. I'm a professor of anthropology and director of the Frisen Institute at the University of Wyoming.
What is Monteverde?
Yeah, so Monteverde is a site in the Los Lagos region of Chile, in southern Chile, northern Patagonia. Argued to be multi-component, argued to be, have some of the evidence, some of the oldest evidence for humans in the Americas. The most important component of the Monteverde site is argued to be 14,500 years old. That's the Monteverde II component. What's really remarkable about the site is its organic preservation. It's argued to preserve a huge range of organic artifacts like house structures and cordage that you really don't see in sites of this age, especially open air sites. The site was excavated by Tom Dillehay in the 1970s and 1980s, and it's considered really sort of groundbreaking, paradigm-breaking in our discipline and the study of the first Americans because it is pre-Clovis. There's a lot of sites that are pre-Clovis, meaning older than about 13,000 BP. But also in 1997, a group of Paleo-Indian archaeologists, American and Chilean, visited the site, evaluated the evidence, and they concluded that it's likely the real deal. It's truly an archaeological site. It's 14,500 years old, and it's really far south. If we believe that the first Americans entered the New World across the Bering Land Bridge, the oldest site in the Americas should not be in southern South America. So for all these reasons, it was really quite groundbreaking.
How did you get interested in the site?
I first learned about Monteverde in 1994. I was an undergraduate student at the University of Wisconsin, and as part of an anthro major, you had to take a senior seminar class. And that's where you take a deep dive in a specific topic in anthropology. So for me, this is like the first time that I took a deep dive in an archaeological topic. And the topic was the colonization of the Americas and the state of knowledge at the time. The professor was Jim Stoltman, and he brought in two guest speakers from outside of the university, and one of them was Tom Dillehay, and he gave a presentation to our class about his work at Monteverde, and I was absolutely astounded because if it was right, and it sure seemed like it was at the time, it suggested that there was all this prehistory in the Americas that we knew nothing about, this period between, say, Clovis and Monteverde, or, you know, even older than Monteverde in North America. Presumably there would have to be sites older than Monteverde in North America. So it actually really inspired my career, because for the first time I could see there's this gap of knowledge where I could make a contribution. And in fact, I should note, the first professional book I ever bought in archaeology was Volume 1 of Monteverde Site, which was published in 1989. So I've been thinking about this site for a long time, for more than 30 years. The site inspired my career, it's always been there in the background for me.
So you would consider yourself a Paleo-Indian archaeologist, correct?
Yeah. I mean, I've done all kinds of things. I've worked with living people in Mongolia. I've worked in the late prehistoric, the archaic, the Neolithic, the middle Paleolithic. But my first love is Paleo-Indian archaeology and the peopling of the Americas. And I would say virtually everything I've done has somehow come out of that study.
For the audience listening, would you consider yourself a Clovis first archaeologist?
Yeah, I would absolutely consider myself a Clovis first archaeologist. You know, I think that people like me are very much in the minority now. And for good reason. There are a lot of sites that have been proposed to be archaeological and older than Clovis in the Americas. I didn't start that way. I started very much a believer in pre-Clovis as I, you know, evolved in my education and professionally. I increasingly came to believe pre-Clovis, at least the evidence that we have right now, very much supports the Clovis first hypothesis, and I don't really see any good evidence for pre-Clovis in the Americas, except in eastern Beringia and Alaska, where the evidence is very clear. There are sites older than Clovis.
Something that I've mentioned often on this channel, too, when the subject of pre-Clovis is brought up, is that I often find pre-Clovis sites objectively to be very ephemeral and scant. You can look at a Paleolithic site in France, a Paleolithic site in Siberia, a Paleolithic site in the Levant, and see very stratified and defined tool assemblages, very defined technologies, and very distinct cultures. And with that, following the Paleolithic tradition of sites in the Old World, Clovis sites in North America often look very similar to that. They're stratified, there's defined tool cultures, and it is a distinct culture that you can see that is kind of ubiquitous across North America and parts of South America. So with all that laid out, I asked Todd here, do you agree that pre-Clovis seems a lot more ephemeral usually and Clovis seems to be more sound?
I would say pre-Clovis, the record of pre-Clovis in the continental United States is very different than the record of Clovis and the record of everything that follows Clovis. So in many ways, so we could just start with abundance. Yeah, there's lots of Clovis sites. There's thousands of Clovis projectile points in terms of buried excavated Clovis sites. There are dozens of them. And they date in a very consistent time period. They're found across the continent and they look like normal archaeological sites produced by hunter-gatherers, meaning they have chipped stone, a lot of flakes. They have hearth features. They're stratigraphically discrete, meaning you can identify components. We have human remains from those time periods. We have things like bison bone beds in the Clovis time period, and from there on after. Pre-Clovis is different. Every pre-Clovis site is a little different. Some of them have artifacts that look a lot like they could have been produced by nature and only those kinds of artifacts, or cut marks on bone or other kind of bone modifications that possibly could have been produced by nature. Other ones look like maybe artifacts have moved down from younger deposits into older sediments, giving the appearance of the sites being older than they actually are. Some of them, there's no artifacts, but other things like footprints at White Sands or at Paisley Caves in Oregon. There's very few artifacts. There's a lot of artifacts above the pre-Clovis, very few in the pre-Clovis. In the pre-Clovis, really, the arguments are based on coprolites, fossil feces that are argued to be human, cut marks on bone, but not the typical things we get in hunter-gatherer archaeological sites. So yeah, it's different. Yeah. Pre-Clovis looks different.
Considering that I wasn't even alive when Monteverde was first published, I asked Todd here, why was Monteverde so explosive? Why was it so controversial at the time?
What made it so explosive? Why was it accepted? Why was it like paradigm busting? Mm-hmm. Well, in 1994, when Volume 1 of the Monteverde book came out, Monteverde had not exploded onto the scene yet. It wasn't until 3 years later in 1997 when the second volume of the site was published. So in general, the paradigm that we use to evaluate whether, you know, sites are truly pre-Clovis is we say, do we have artifacts or human remains that are in undisturbed stratigraphic context that are associated with incontrovertible radiocarbon dates or other kinds of dates. If you have those things, things made by humans, good dates, in undisturbed stratigraphy, it's hard to argue how could this be anything but real evidence for humans present at a site before Clovis, right? So in 1997, when Volume 2 of Monteverde came out, where really the bulk of the archaeological evidence was presented, most people believed, including leading experts at the time, believed that those criteria had been met, that there truly were artifacts, even though they were unusual. And what I mean by unusual is that, you know, there's things like vertical pieces of wood argued to be stakes with what's argued to be cordage tied around it with knots. It's argued to be like animal proteins, meat, and leather still preserved at the site, even adhering to wood. There's argued to be house foundations, wooden house foundations present. It's argued to be things like medicinal plants, seaweed, that were brought in by people. The radiocarbon dating looked really solid. The stratigraphy looked really solid. It looked like it was sealed by this gravel that meant you couldn't have younger materials moving down into these older deposits. Everything looked really, really solid, such that when this independent team went down to analyze the events in 1997, they concluded this is very likely the real deal. And that pretty much satisfied the discipline. Now, they left the door open. They said, you know, future researchers might not agree, might have opportunity to do new kinds of analyses, collect new kinds of data that might, you know, change this conclusion. But given the evidence at hand, the evidence we evaluated, pre-Clovis is real. And there's a lot that we don't understand now, given the location and age of the site.
Yeah. You had mentioned earlier that a special team went down there to verify the integrity of the site. Can you talk more about that?
At least to the best of my memory. I might miss somebody here, but yeah, the group that was assembled to evaluate the evidence at Monteverde included David Meltzer, who really organized that trip, C. Vance Haynes Jr., Dina Dinkaus, Dennis Stanford, Don Grayson. I think that was the American contingent, and then two Chilean archaeologists, Lautaro Nunez and Francisco Mena. All looked at both the artifacts. I think they listened to lectures. I'm not sure about the exact details. I know they visited the site because I have photographs that Vance gave me of the site visit in January of 1997. Yeah, that was the group. Sort of, you know, a lot of the leading minds in the discipline at the time.
So it is safe to say at the time this was a groundbreaking site.
Yeah, they rewrote the textbooks. Okay. I mean, you won't find a world history textbook or a North American prehistory textbook that doesn't include special mention of Monteverde.
Okay.
Yeah. And of course, it's not a minor thing to push back the date of human colonization. Keep in mind the Americas, like if we think of humans colonizing the entire planet, right? The Americas were the last major landmass to be colonized by humans. Of course, excluding Antarctica, which really still hasn't been seriously colonized, but and later certain island areas were colonized. But you know, before humans entered the Americas, we had this massive continent, essentially half of the planet, where there was nobody, right? So the timing of this event as a moment in human history is like really, really important, which of course is why the Folsom discovery was so important, and the Clovis discovery was very important, and Monteverde, you know, equally important from a historical point of view. Yeah.
Can you tell the audience a little more about the Folsom discovery?
Yeah, the Folsom discovery, I want to say 1928, but I think it was actually 1927, when archaeologists working on behalf of the Denver Museum of Nature and Science discovered fluted spear points in association with Bison antiquus in a site in northeastern New Mexico that showed for the first time that humans were present in the Americas during the Ice Age, because you had clear association between human-made things and extinct bison. And then I want to say 1936 approximately is when artifacts were first found in situ at Blackwater Draw in also northeastern New Mexico or eastern New Mexico, associated with mammoth, stratigraphically beneath Folsom points associated with bison. We couldn't date them using radiocarbon. It didn't exist at the time, but stratigraphically showed Folsom wasn't the oldest. There was something here before Folsom, and that was Clovis. And of course, since then, we haven't been able to find anything stratigraphically beneath Clovis, although some archaeologists have argued they have.
So getting more into the story now, I want to ask Todd, how did this research come about? Like, why am I interviewing you today?
Well, I mean, I told you this story for me starts in 1994, but you know, it picks up again, like right before COVID. I taught a class on a New World Colonization, a graduate seminar, and I got thinking about these problems again, and I was thinking about Monteverde, and I started obsessing about the seaweed at Monteverde is what happened. I was just thinking about this. You have this peat bog that's, you know, from the Pleistocene. It's got all these little tiny pieces of plants in there, and they argue they have seaweed. Now, seaweed shouldn't be there. Naturally, this is, you know, more than 20 miles from the coast today and farther from the coast than the Pleistocene. So if seaweed is there, it's pretty good evidence that humans were there. And I thought, how is the seaweed identified? These little bits of plant remains, could it have been misidentified? So I thought of an interesting research design where we could actually chemically test this seaweed, isotopically examine this seaweed, because isotopically, it should look very different than terrestrial plants. Grows in the ocean, plants grow in the atmosphere. That was a simple research design I came up with. I'd go down to Chile, we'd collect seaweed and terrestrial plants, characterize them isotopically, sort of look at the modern baseline, and then we could look at the Monteverde collections and, you know, test whether the seaweed is really seaweed. I found a Chilean colleague, Claudio La Torre, to help me with this project, and then we reached out to Tom Delahaye to ask him if he wanted to collaborate on it. And Tom's answer was basically that's impossible because the seaweed burned up in a fire It's long gone. So you know, nice idea, but it's just not possible. And that was a bummer. But Claudio and I were undeterred. We decided, well, let's go down and collect the modern samples anyway. You know, maybe one of these seaweed samples will show up eventually. If it does, we'll have done the baseline work. So in January of 2021, just after COVID, I went down there and met Claudio, and it was awesome. We spent time on beaches collecting all the seaweed in temperate rainforests, collecting plants. But while we were down there, Claudio was like, we should go see Monteverde. And I was like, hell yeah, I want to see the site. I've been reading about it and thinking about it for, you know, 25 years at that point. So we visited Monteverde. Monteverde is a national monument in Chile. And if you go there, there's not much there. There's a creek. It's along Chinchihuapi Creek. And there's a little interpretive trail with signs. So we're walking along and we're looking at deposits there. And I'm with Claudio and his son, Martin. And I'm showing Claudio these deposits. And we're looking at like a cut bank along the stream. And I tell Claudio, I'm like, there's actually a huge piece of wood sticking out of it, which is pretty cool. I mean, this place does preserve like organic matter remarkably well. And I'm telling Claudio, this is the terrace that buries the MV2 component, the 14,500-year-old component. And I should note that Claudio is a paleoecologist. And when he was an undergraduate in the 90s, he had worked in this region with geologists who were studying the glacial deposits down there. This area was glaciated in the Pleistocene, and these geologists are trying to figure out if Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere glaciation were synchronous. So he was generally familiar with the area, but hadn't been down there for a while. And we're looking at these deposits, and I'm telling him, this is where the Monteverde II component is. And he says, are you sure? And I'm like, oh yeah, I'm sure. Trust me, I studied this site inside and out. And he's like, I don't think this is Pleistocene. And I said, well, it's really well dated. I mean, there's lots of 14,000 plus year old dates out of it. Well, why don't you think it's Pleistocene? And he said, you know, the color of it just looks Holocene to me. Like this was deposited under the temperate rainforest. And in the Pleistocene, for much of the Pleistocene, this was periglacial, meaning there was a huge glacier that came out of the Andes that came within like 4 miles of the site. So at the height of the Pleistocene, this was pretty much a treeless glacial outwash plain. So if you go on Google Earth and look like at the end of a glacier in Greenland and all the water and sand and gravel out in front of it, that's what Monteverde looked like 20,000 years ago, okay? With these braided outwash streams. And he's like, this looks like it was formed under a Holocene forest, not under Pleistocene conditions. And I was like, okay, you know, evidence really doesn't, like the dating of it doesn't support that. And then we're looking at another like cut bank, and he says, and we're looking at this ball of peat that's in it. And he says, that peat's not in situ, that's redeposited. And then he says to me, what if all this organic matter is redeposited? Okay, so within 10 minutes of being at the site, my Chilean colleague comes up with this hypothesis that the Monteverde site isn't in a Pleistocene deposit, meaning it doesn't date to the Ice Age at all. It dates to the Holocene, dates to the last, sometime within the last 10,000 years. And that all that organic matter and stuff, whether it's artifacts or not, was redeposited. It might be old, it might be 14,500 years old, but it's in a deposit that's way younger than that. That's maybe 8,000, maybe 6,000 years old. If he was right, this would mean the Monteverde site wasn't 14,500 years old. I mean, it was more like 6,000 to 8,000 years old. So, of course, I'm like, man, there is no way this is right, Claudio. I mean, people have been studying this situation for, you know, at this point, 27 years. So just to finish this story, in January 2021, you know, Claudio comes up with this idea that all this organic matter we're seeing in this terrace is redeposited. And I say, well, Claudio, if that's the case, it's got to be redeposited from somewhere. There's got to be, if you're right, there's got to be some source for wood and peat from an older deposit. So let's go look at some older deposits. And at Monteverde, there's really two geologic units. There's this low younger terrace that's very orange in color, and this high older terrace that's gray in color that is widely accepted to be the glacial outwash. So we go look at the cut bank on one of these high terraces, and in the top of it, we see big pieces of wood sticking out, and we see peat. And I think, oh my God, This is completely plausible. This is a plausible idea that needs to be tested. That was January 2021. And then we decided, Claudio and I worked to develop a research design to actually test that hypothesis. And it took us another 3 years to get all that work done. And we expanded our team to include Cesar Mendez, an archaeologist who works in Chile, and Juan Luis Garcia, who's a geomorphologist who studies glacial Elwash.
So before you, was anyone else able to go sample and look at the site?
I mean, yes and no. Everybody's had access to the data that has been available. To my knowledge, nobody's been able to sample at the site, except for Vance Haynes in 1997, where they gave him a couple of profiles that were pre-prepared that he was able to sample. I think that's the only other dating that had been done. In fact, he hadn't dated those samples.
So with the introduction and Todd's intro to the story out of the way, let me quickly recap what Monteverde is. Monteverde is a site located in South America towards Patagonia that was excavated in the late 1970s and early 1980s. The excavations were led by American archaeologist Dr. Tom Dillahay, who at the time was at the University of Kentucky, but now he works at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. When the site was excavated, they originally found lithics, wooden tools, floral and faunal remains, and also seaweed. As for the lithic tools at the site, they found small flake tools and unifacial scrapers, bifacial points that were lanceolate in form, though as we'll get into later, these might be more Holocene era in shape and size and typology. They also found notchers, choppers, and large informal bifaces. They also found polished stone artifacts at the site, like you'll see here, but as we'll talk about later, these tools might not be Ice Age in typology. They seem to be similar to those found in early Holocene and archaic ones around the surrounding area. As for the organic artifacts, these preserved pretty well due to the swampy and bog-like environment of the site. Dillahay and co. believed they found wooden tools, possibly lances and digging sticks. They also laid out that they found possible architectural elements like tent stakes with twine wrapped around them, as well as planks. Though as we'll talk about later, this might not be the case. They also found twisted plant fibers and cordage. They also found quids of seaweed at the site, which were possibly masticated and chewed by humans, or at least bundled up marine algae. And Dillahay also posited that these were used as food or medicine, which is why, as you'll see in the famous painting by Greg Harlan of Monteverde, a medicine woman giving the medicine bundle to a person who is either infirm or otherwise laying on the ground injured or something to that extent. As for the faunal remains, which these are very Ice Age in nature, they found the bones of extinct gompatheres, which are related to elephants, mammoths, and mastodons, and they also found extinct Ice Age camels. And while gompatheres and camels are definitely Ice Age in taxonomy and age, as we'll talk about later, they seem to be from an older part of the creek that was redeposited on top of the Monteverde component. One thing I will state, though, that is remarkable about this site is due to the peat bog and the swampy nature of the geology of the area, that's why everything preserves so well. It preserves into a peat bog and it makes for great preservation, which is why this site at the time seemed so significant, because these things like food, medicine, and extinct Ice Age animals were preserved well in the peat bog area. So moving on to the methods and materials, I want to kind of reiterate what the paper talks about. This study is the first study of Monteverde not led by its original researchers. Todd and co-authors studied 9 soil and stratigraphic exposures along the Chinchihuapi Creek. They used radiocarbon dating, OSL dating, which is optically stimulated luminescence dating, as well as tephrochronology, which is a study of volcanic ash. But what Todd and co. did was excavated and mapped natural exposures along the Chinchihuapi Creek in a nearby quarry. They collected wood, charcoal, sediment, and sand for dating using radiocarbon, tephra, and OSL. And they used PVC tubes for OSL samples and 3D scanning to record stratigraphy, as well as a bunch of drone photography to create 3D models of the site. As for the radiocarbon dating, if you're not familiar, just a quick recap. Everything, including you, is a carbon-based organism. Anything that, you know, is a carbon-based organism that lives on this planet is carbon-based, and it takes in carbon when it's alive. So let's use an example of wood at the site. Wood near that site takes in carbon when it's alive. When it dies, it stops taking in carbon. Once it dies and stops taking in carbon, we can then collect a carbon date sample or a piece of carbon, usually from a piece of wood, a piece of charcoal from a fire pit, or just extract it from the wood itself here, put that into an AMS machine, which is an accelerated mass spectrometer, and understand the rate of decay of that carbon. Basically, understanding and measuring how long it's been since the day it stopped taking in carbon, or the day it died. But as for optical luminescence dating, essentially that determines when sediments were last exposed to light. So for the purposes of this study, what they did was take alluvial sand at the site, and they did OSL dating to measure the last time that grain of sediment was exposed to sunlight. So in combination with the radiocarbon dates they got from the wood, they determined with OSL dating, the last time that sand was exposed to light, they determined with the study that the wood at that site is 6,000 years older than the sand that was buried there. So the sand got put on top of that wood. As for tephrochronology is the study of volcanic ash. Think about Pompeii. Every time a volcano explodes, like the one at Pompeii, it has a unique chemical signature or a physical signature that then blankets the landscape, and you can find that all over the place. And you can then find different volcanic explosions in the surrounding area like they did here at Monteverde. So with pollen cores that were taken from previous studies and this study around the area by Lake Condrito, and then based on geochem, you know the age and context is 11,000 years old. So all that said, based on the volcanic explosions in the area and the ones that are at Monteverde seem to be older than the site. In sum, they identified that a volcanic ash layer called the Lipui Tephra dated to about 11,000 BP, and this sits below the Monteverde II layer. That means that Monteverde II must be younger than 11,000 years old. It is not pre-Clovis. So essentially, with carbon dating, soil dating, and volcanic dating, they can tell that Monteverde is not as old as it seems. So if all that was confusing, you didn't quite follow along, or maybe you did get it, I have Todd here explain the results in his own words.
Yeah. Let me just talk about the evidence a little bit, okay?
Yeah.
So at Monteverde, you have these old deposits. The bottom of them are sands and gravels, meters and meters of this. And this is just stuff that washed out of this glacier, okay? And then as you get to, and that's like 15, 16,000 years old. As you get to the top of that, it gets finer and finer and finer. And then the forest actually moves in and you get this big bed of wood that was all across that valley. There was a forest in there and you see these big chunks of wood sticking out of the top of this bank. And that dates to 14,500 years ago. But it's in a different landform than the Monteverde. It's in the upper terrace, okay? Then that gets buried by this peat. That's kind of terminal Pleistocene, end of the last ice age. That's buried by volcanic ash. And this volcanic ash is really important to this story because it's a regional stratigraphic marker. You see this little yellow band in the top of this terrace. And what's cool about volcanic ash is they're all chemically unique. So you can do the geochemistry of it. You can identify exactly which volcanic ash it is. You can identify exactly which volcano it came out of. You know its exact age because we find it in stratigraphic context. It's found all over the place in stratigraphic context, including things like pollen cores from lakes where it's really well dated, okay? And that thing is 11,000 years old. It's called the Lipui Tephra. It's 11,000 years old. And it's everywhere regionally, right? You would think, if the Monteverde II site is 14,500 years old, that ash should be stratigraphically above that. But it's not. It's stratigraphically below it. That alone, the presence of that ash, which we documented in four different sections up and down this creek, tells you the Monteverde II component has to be younger than 11,000 calendar years before present. That alone. So there's a lot of evidence we looked at, radiocarbon dating, OSL dating, and it all points into the same conclusion. This is a Holocene deposit. This is a lot younger than what they thought it was.
If that's not clicking for you, or the graphs that were provided in the manuscript that I animated here didn't make as much sense to you as I thought they would, let me just reiterate here, looking at this graph, that all of the stuff that comprised the old Monteverde site that's sitting in that brown stuff in the glacial outwash with those two red arrows should technically sit below that Lipui Tephra layer, but it doesn't. The Lipui Tephra layer is found above it at Monteverde. So that means that all that brown stuff there in the middle with that little piece of water means that sometime between 8,000 and 4,000 years ago, that stuff was washed down the creek and brought and put into that spot where De La Haye originally excavated Monteverde. So therefore, Monteverde is not 14,500 years old. It is only 11,000 years old or younger. So as I mentioned with the carbon dating stuff earlier, the wood was carbon dated to be 6,000 years older than the last time that soil was exposed to sunlight. It's all muddled from down the creek and put there. Likewise, with the gompatheres and the extinct camels, those are Ice Age animals, they were washed from up creek down and deposited onto this site in the cut bank there where Monteverde II was found. So therefore, it's just a bunch of stuff washed from up the creek down onto what Monteverde was. So that means at the time when De La Haye excavated the site, it did look Ice Age in nature. It had Ice Age animals, it had Ice Age deposits and things like that. But we know now with the volcanic ash dating that it can't be any older than 11,000 years old. And that means that those points I talked about too, that Dillehay claims to be Paleo-Indian or Ice Age in typology, are not. They're actually, as they do, look very similar to Holocene and other archaic era points in the area, were washed down the creek and put on top at the site here. They're mixed context with those Ice Age animals. So it would make sense that you would excavate it at the time and see it as an Ice Age site, but it's not. As well, we mentioned that twine and the stuff that was tied around the tent stakes, that if it is twine that was tied around the tent stakes, sure, that makes sense if it's a Holocene era site. If it's seaweed from a medicine bundle, it was seaweed chewed by people after the Ice Age, not during. And that twine, too, if you see all the wood and the planks and stuff, and the twine and the reeds that are up the creek of the site, a lot of that is just washed down the creek and wrapped around that possible tent stake, and then fossilized over years, becoming and looking like something like a tent stake. It's either stuff washing down the creek, wrapping around that wood, or it's stuff that maybe it was a tent stake, and even if it was, it doesn't date to the Ice Age. It is Holocene in era. What this means here too, and just to reiterate, Monteverde is no longer solid evidence for people in South America 14,500 years ago. Instead, it does, though, fit neatly into the Middle Holocene era archaeology of Chile and the surrounding areas. It makes sense for that. As such, the artifacts that I talked about do compare well to other Holocene era sites. So all that said, this forces a re-evaluation of everything we know about the peopling of the Americas. Yes, other pre-Clovis sites in North America and some in South America might still have some validity, but sites like this, like Monteverde, this is why intense scrutiny and skepticism when they come out is important, because things like this can be found in geoarchaeology and other different types of sampling can be done to understand that they're not exactly what they seem, especially when we only see clickbait titles in the news. Whether or not this reopens the Clovis first model or makes that the dominant model again, I doubt people will believe that, but it does open the doors to that being a possible claim again. So the bottom line here, though, and I wrote this down, Monteverde artifacts don't prove Ice Age settlement. They're from a much younger context. The ice-free corridor hypothesis was abandoned because of Monteverde specifically. So the idea that people were coming across the Bering land bridge into the Americas was defunct, and a lot of people say that it's not true anymore because of Monteverde specifically. However, Monteverde is not an Ice Age site at all. Forget it exists, it's just a later Holocene era site. That stuff might still be true. So with everything I just laid out with the methods and the results of this paper, let me just ask Todd, what was your goal with this paper? What were you trying to accomplish?
What's my goal? Okay, let me answer that a couple ways.
Yeah.
Look, science is the pursuit of truth, right? I just want to know when people arrive in the Americas. It's kind of a dumb, simple question, but one that's vexed us for a long time. So on the one hand, I want to know, and knowing the age of this site, it helps us to answer that question. I think there are a couple lessons here. One, sometimes science gets it wrong. But science is a really remarkable self-corrective process. In the long run, in my opinion, it always gets it right. And what this study really shows is the value of independent evaluation or independent replication. You know, in laboratory science, that's normal. You do some experiment on a bench in your lab, you write up the methods. Anybody else with a lab bench and that equipment and those materials can do the same experiment and replicate or not your results. In archaeology, we are really bad at this. We're really bad at allowing this. There's a culture of ownership of sites, of ownership of collections that tends to prevent this kind of work, right? And again, I'm not even saying we're right. All I'm saying is when we did try to do an independent replication, we failed and we came up with another story. Our work also should be subject to the same process. Other people should go in and do it. But in general, when you're making extreme claims that are paradigm changing, those especially should be subject to independent verification. That is not what happened in 1997. Those people were not allowed to collect samples anywhere they wanted. They were not allowed to do excavations. They were not given unfettered access to the collections. That's the case at many pre-Clovis sites. And I really think we need to change the culture of archaeology. And this is an excellent example of this. Maybe this is not the right parallel to make, but I'm sure you're familiar with the case of Piltdown Man, right? Which was supposed to change the story of human evolution, supposed to be the missing link between apes and humans. Turns out the whole thing was a forgery. You know why it took something like 40 years to figure that out? Because the scientists at the Natural History Museum in London who controlled the specimen would not allow access to it. And it wasn't until he passed away that scientists got access to it, and very quickly it was discovered the entire thing was a fake. And I'm not saying Monteverde is a fake, but what I'm saying is that when you put sites and collections under lock and key and prevent independent evaluation, it slows the progress of science, you know? So to me, like, that's the most important lesson out of this. Yeah, Monteverde may not be as revolutionary as we thought it was, but it really should be a lesson to our discipline. It's time to change how we do things.
Yeah.
It seems to me like a lot of pre-Clovis sites and things like that, even if there's a piece of evidence, say it's debitage, a bone, or something ephemeral, it always gets eaten up and swallowed by mainstream media. And I've seen, like, Cerruti was on ESPN News. I've seen that.
Was it really?
And it was like a banner, like, on the bottom of some picture of it. But like, Cerruti, for example, and Topper comes to CNN, and then an archaeologist baffled. With Monteverde, that was a site like this. So for people that are going to watch this video of me interviewing you here, coming to be like, well, that can't be true. Like, Monteverde is the site that makes, like, what? Do you see where I'm going with that?
I do.
Yeah.
Look, I told you in 1994, Tom DeLahaye gave an incredibly compelling talk to me about Monteverde that inspired my entire career. 30 years later, I decided he was wrong. Whether you think I'm right or wrong, I encourage you to figure out a way to evaluate what I'm saying. Yeah. Right? You know, become an archaeologist. You can look at the data we've published. You can look at that and you can evaluate it yourself. You can look at all the data that has been published on Monteverde, these huge amount, and become an archaeologist, get a permit, collect your own samples. I encourage that. I have no ownership of this, nor do I want any. Please test everything we've done. That's the simple answer.
Okay.
But what I want to say, when you mentioned like Cerruti showing up on ESPN, the ESPN crawl or whatever, about how all these sites are splashed across the pages of the New York Times and they're, you know, they make the nightly news and things like that. In my experience, when scientific claims reach that level of publicity, they're usually bullshit. I'm not saying they're always bullshit. Certainly, groundbreaking discoveries do happen. But let me put it to you this way, in terms of like thinking about finding the oldest site in the Americas. We've been looking now for a long damn time. You know, if we talk about since Folsom, nearly 100 years, but we were looking long before that. So let's say I've been looking for the oldest site for 150 years. In that process, we've investigated, let's say, I would say somewhere between 50 and 100,000 sites. Okay. It seems like with a sample of that size, you ought to be pretty close to the damn answer, right? And that you really shouldn't expect something to come along that's just going to blow everything out of the water that's unlike anything we've ever seen. It's just incredibly unlikely at this point. It was likely in 1928, and it sure happened then, but it's really not likely anymore. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's really, really unlikely. So when you see these really extreme claims, your first position should be skepticism. I'm not saying disbelief. I'm saying skepticism.
Sure.
If you're familiar with my channel, you know I don't often talk about this. It's not really in my wheelhouse. It's not really something I like talking about, but it's just something that I think is important to mention here. Monteverde is something I see discussed all the time among pseudo-archaeologists, but not just pseudo-archaeologists, but avocational archaeologists, alternative archaeologists, alternative historians. People on the internet, people in my comment sections like you, will point out that Monteverde is the smoking gun that establishes Clovis First as gone, or negates the Bering Land Bridge theory and all that. So I asked Todd here, as an establishment Clovis First, Clovis Mafia archaeologist, why should these people listen to you, and why is this research important for them to take into their understanding, even if they don't agree with it?
Anything else you want to say to that?
I get to the Hancock people?
Yeah.
I'm not super educated about the Hancock stuff, but I saw the part, I guess, in the discussion with Flint Dibble, where he says there's still people questioning whether Clovis is first, and that's been settled for a long time. Look, like if you read the popular accounts, the Wikipedia pages, the archaeology textbooks, it seems like it's been settled for a long time. I will tell you, being a professional working in this discipline, this is my specialty, and there are a lot of us. There are a lot of us who have long felt it hasn't been settled. I'm talking about the people with true expertise, the people who really dig sites of this age, people who go and look for them. This has not settled. It isn't. And I can show you example after example of literature from the scientific literature, legit stuff that's been published before Monteverde and since Monteverde, making arguments that, yeah, Clovis I is still very much alive and well. And by the way, for really good reason, because the vast majority of evidence supports it. There's just these weird little anomalous things that don't. I don't know what to say about Hancock, but I hope criticizing me becomes a standard part of his his discussion now. Yeah. I don't mind that at all.
So with everything we just laid out, this will obviously cause a firestorm in the news, and at least, if not the news, the archaeological community might send shockwaves, to be honest. So with all that said, I asked Todd, can you speak to that, and why are you in the news, and why should people listen to you?
A major field of science got it wrong for a quarter century. Not only got it wrong, but was pretty convinced they had it right. Like, this was sort of almost portrayed to be unquestionable fact of science, and we got it wrong. So I think have a skeptical mind. Don't believe experts. I am one. So I understand the irony there, but I have a skeptical mind.
With all of that said, I'll give you my opinion based on what I've seen here and the stuff in these graphs and the stuff in the pictures and all the excavations and all the sampling work I saw that Todd showed me. It does seem that Monteverde is no longer a viable pre-Clovis site. However, as Todd said, leave that up to you. That is up for you to determine if you want to replicate this again, if you want to do the sampling and the site stuff, become an archaeologist, test it out yourself, see what you think. And hopefully, as I said with most stuff, and I say this with every huge article that comes out, and as Todd pointed out, this stuff can be clickbait, huge headline, first people's dates pushed back stuff is often bullshit, because a few weeks later, or a few months later, a rebuttal will come out that says the complete opposite, but the rebuttal, of course, doesn't get the media attention and the clicks that it deserves, because the other stuff is more sensationalized, and I get that. My whole career works off of making clickbait titles. You probably clicked on this video for that same thing. So we're all guilty of it. It's just kind of how the world works. But when you look at the science and you see the science that's packed into this stuff, make your own decisions. And I hope that you read. I hope that you take into consideration the stuff that Todd said, take into consideration stuff that you know about the people in the Americas already, and form your own opinion like I have now. So with that said, thank you for watching. Please remember to rate and review. Please hit the like button. I think there's a new hype button now you're supposed to hit. If you enjoyed this video, please do that. And if you have comments, questions, or concerns, please, please put them in the comment section. I'll send them to Todd for him to look at, or he can look them up on my YouTube channel if he wants to. And if you want to contact Dr. Surivel, he's a professor of anthropology at the University of Wyoming, and you can find his contact information there, and I'll put it in the description. So with all that, thank you very much for watching. Please leave those questions and comments in there. And if you have questions about other Clovis sites or other pre-Clovis sites that you think might be possibly incorrect or false or misleading, put those in the comments and let us know. Thank you very much, and that is it.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at Jessica at at livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.